Since 9/11, Australian government, state and federal, have passed a lot of anti-terror legislation, usually with bipartisan support and often without much parliamentary scrutiny or debate. Preventing terrorism is without doubt important, but do anti-terror laws strike the right balance between individual liberties and security imperatives? That's a question raised squarely by the case of George Dixon, an often homeless man who, by his own account, is a prolific long-term user of marijuana, and he regards himself as a political activist for drug law reform. George Dixon's legal misadventures are the subject of a new article in The Monthly called The Aquarian Terrorist, which is written by former Sunday Extra host Hugh Rimmington. The article features another luminary of Australian journalism, Mark Davis. You might remember Mark as the Gold Walkley winning investigative journalist on programs like Four Corners and Dateline on SBS. These days, Mark is a criminal lawyer, and he's been George Dixon's legal aid-funded lawyer as his client ended up being categorised as, quote, a high-risk terrorist offender and subjected to a series of control orders. Mark Davis, welcome to Sunday Extra.
Hello, John.
Could you give us a quick outline of George Dixon's life story before he was subject to the control order?
Well, look, nothing out of the ordinary, except that he does have a... I'm wary of using the word fixation, but his primary interest in life, his primary political interest in life, is drug reform. He's a marijuana user himself, and he's advocated for its decriminalisation for well over a decade.
And I suppose it's the particular way that he's expressed that advocacy which has caused him problems. Could you sort of characterise how he goes about this activism?
Look, really, it wasn't his activism that led him to the attention of the police.
So
his activism was a prolific writer, you know, and a frequent writer of offensive emails to various politicians in Australia and police. So that's his modus operandi. And many leaflets stuck on, power poles. That's probably what he's done, essentially, over the last 10 years. But what tripped him up was this. He's in Nimbin, of all places. The guy's in Nimbin and police decide to do a drug raid. He's found with, shock horror, he's found to be in possession of marijuana at the Nimbin Marijuana Festival.
Right.
He gets taken to Lismore, down the mountain, taken to Lismore. He's charged, then released. And he's released in the middle of the night, maybe 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, I think it might have been. He's got scant clothing on, he's got no shoes, it's cold, and it's a 30-kilometre walk back up the mountain, and they won't drive him. So he's, irate. He goes outside, he picks up a rock, and he smashes the windscreen of two police cars. There's no police in the cars. That's the beginning of his journey on a very terrifying journey, and I mean terrifying for us all, not just for George Dixon.
I mean, obviously, throwing a rock at a police car is going to get you in some sort of trouble, but it does. The connection to anti-terror laws is not obvious. Could you help sort of chart the link for us, and in particular, what this term terrorism context means in New South Wales law?
Well, what it means is you don't have to be a terrorist, incredibly. You don't have to be a terrorist to come under the Terrorism High Risk Offender Act. And this was frequently mentioned in proceedings, almost in passing, almost like, well, no one's saying he's a terrorist, but he's going to get a terrorist high risk offender order upon him.
Yeah, because so that definition of terrorism context says you've just got to have the intention of advancing a political, religious or ideological cause and the intention of coercing or influencing by intimidation governments. And George Dixon's, some of his more colourful statements err into that territory. But still, how does he end up being charged and treated under this legislation?
Because it's a checklist. It's a checklist for predictive crimes. Now, we're really entering new space here when you don't commit an offence, but the experts, the men and women in white coats, when they have a checklist, they start to predict that you're going to commit a crime. Now, that's the most chilling thing you can sort of comprehend as a lawyer or as anybody, that we've entered this stage of predicting crimes. And you get a little number between 1 and 5 of your chance of committing a terrorist offence. And for George, of course, the checklist, even when we look at it, it seems benign, but the checklist is as follows. In court, he said, I believe in Aboriginal law, not the laws of the invader. A fairly commonly held view by many people in Australia, in fact. And yet, of course, to somebody in the system, it sounds a bit like ISIS, doesn't it? ISIS believes in the caliphate.
Well, that's a political statement. I suppose it involves the government and the jurisdiction of Australia. So, yeah, you can see how it's
and then strike two. Strike two. He advocates for the smoking of marijuana. Now, that's an illegal offence, isn't it? So that's strike two. That's striking at the laws of Australia. And his strike three, apart from having been previously been an annoying person to politicians and police, his strike three, but I think this was a construct. I'm not satisfied there was any serious concern about this. I felt like it was just the third tick in the box. In prison, in a group session, he said, and he says he said it as a joke, that he should have burnt down the police station, not just broken the windows. And then he's alleged to have said, I should burn down all the police stations of in New South Wales. Now, he says it was a joke amongst 20 inmates, and everyone was joining in on that joke. Now, I can promise you from the number of times I've spent in prison, there are many such jokes in prisons of all places.
Fairly robust jokes made in prison. Yeah.
Yes. And that was his strike three. And then the train began, and that train wasn't going to stop until, you know, he was, well, ultimately he was freed, but they were hoping that he would not be freed. He came under the Act. The Act hadn't been in for very long. The Act came in at the very last weeks of 2017, and George came within its ambit by 2018.
We're speaking here about the Terrorism High Risk Offenders Act 2017 New South Wales, and we're discussing it with former Gold Walkley winning journalist and now criminal lawyer Mark Davis, whose client George Dixon fell afoul of that legislation. Mark, when he got out, George was subjected to a control order. So he hadn't committed any new offences. But what did that control order mean for his life?
So the Act provides for either the continuing detention without a further offence, the continuing detention of an inmate, or a control order. Now the control order is a bracelet on your leg. You are confined to a certain residence. You are monitored by all means. You're not allowed to have a computer or email, smartphone, any of those sort of things. Now, but for George, it was particularly onerous. The assumption or the legislation assumes, okay, you've been in prison, you're released, you go home, but we want to keep an eye on you. Now, that sounds sort of reasonable on one level. George doesn't live in New South Wales. George is from Adelaide. He gets arrested in Nimbin. He's taken to police, to prison in Sydney. It's not a city he knows. He knows no one here. He's got no home to go to. Mm. He can't return to Adelaide. They put him in a homeless shelter. He can't. He asked me, am I able to, rent a house or something of that nature? He didn't have much money. And I said, well, under the Act, technically you are. But to do that, he needs to declare that he's a terrorist high-risk offender to his housemates and the police, which you're not going to do well on Gumtree.
It's not a great opener for your tenancy interview, is it? No.
Yeah. And then the police need to vet every person you come into contact with. And, in fact, he needed to give them a weekly schedule. If he wanted to meet someone, indeed, if he wanted to go and have a cup of coffee, he had to tell them a week ahead. And they have this entire team of the High Risk Offenders Unit, very large, very well-funded team that approve everything he needs to do. It's an absurd order, and a particularly absurd order for an innocent man.
So Mark, why was this order granted? I mean, you might understand the authorities applying for it, even if that was a misjudgment. But why was the order granted?
The interim order, you get an interim order for 3 months. And they are, though the way that the act is written, there's not much discretion on behalf of the judge. Right. He is to give full weight to everything that the police say, right? So it's not scrutinised in any particular way. So the idea is, okay, well, for 3 months we'll do it, and then we'll have a final hearing. So what happened to George was, of course, he got the interim order, his life was held for 3 months, and when we finally got him into a courtroom, we got him off. But in those 3 months, just as a, you know, a personal detail, George is about to be released from prison. His father is dying. George, of course, tells the police, oh, look, his father's dying, he wants to go back to Adelaide. Well, there's a process, of course. Oh, okay, well, they wouldn't let him go back to Adelaide. His father dies. They wouldn't let him go to the funeral. Now, this is an innocent man. They would not let him go to the funeral. His father died thinking that his son was a terrorist. He couldn't explain to his dad what George barely understood it himself what was going on.
Yeah.
All his father knew in his dying days was his son had been labelled a terrorist. And then his father dies and George spends the day of his father's funeral in a homeless shelter in Western Sydney with police outside, plainclothes police sitting in a car outside his house.
It's extraordinary. It's
pretty shocking.
The obvious problem here is the legislation itself and how broadly it can be applied. Are you aware of other cases of these sorts of control orders being granted in places you just wouldn't expect them to be?
Well, there's been very few, but because the Act's very new, so it takes a while to sort of grind through. I mean, look, I'm aware of a couple where I think any reasonable person. I mean, I don't agree with this law. I think it's outrageous to have predictive crimes, and they're based upon I think, again, disgracefully, upon health professionals who are now embedded in the police system, who do these little analyses, these little checklists, and they come up with a number. It's pretty creepy stuff, predicting that you're going to offend. Now, some of these people, I agree, well, I'm glad someone's watching them. You know, I'd put it as high as that. I'm glad someone's watching them. I'm glad the police are checking on them. Well, I think they could have done that anyway, rather than bringing in such a draconian piece of legislation that not only has been misapplied, in my view, has been misapplied in George Dixon's case, it will continue to be misapplied.
Yeah.
It's very dangerous stuff.
And that's the risk, I suppose, the creep from when, I think, you know, control orders were used against, say, David Hicks when he came back from Guantanamo Bay,
yes.
People who've been detained of actually plotting terrorism offences. But it seems that the legislation itself allows for much broader use of these laws.
Actual terrorists, please.
Yeah.
You've got to be an actual terrorist. Might be a good start, right?
Yeah, and I mean, is there any sense from the authorities on the other side that this was a misstep and an abuse of the process? Because just because the law exists doesn't mean that it needs to be used to the full extent of its breadth.
Well, I can tell you, Julian, and I'm not speaking out of school, there's a large number of people. George probably had 20 people whose full-time job, you know, was circulating around this dangerous terrorist. Mm. I could tell that they thought this was absurd themselves, right? But that didn't give much comfort to me. They still went ahead with it. They still did this job.
Yeah.
They still refused him going to his father's funeral. I know what they felt.
Yes.
But, well, it's a job, right?
Yeah.
We all do our job.
And, look, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. But, Mark Davis, thank you very much for doing both your jobs today as a lawyer and a journalist. It's been great speaking with you about the very concerning case of George Dixon.
Thanks, Julian.
And that was Mark Davis, former Gold Walkley winning journalist and now criminal lawyer.